To see examples of what we talk about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
Hey guys, this is Dallas. This week we'll be featuring another episode of Destination Nightmare, which is one of Al's other podcasts. So we hope you enjoy it. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week.
Destination Nightmare Part 3. Take 3, I should say. I'm Dr. Morbius. I have Don here with me. How you doing, Don?
I'm good. How are you?
Don brought me the book called The Fifth Beetle. And I did see, and I did look at it at the Comics World. And it looks pretty nice. Now, you've read it.
Yes.
Is there anything in this book that you didn't know from before? I mean, because you've read up on Beetles.
Yeah. It's a lot of things I was aware of, but this was all from their manager, Brian Epstein's, his
point of view, his story. Yeah.
And they always kind of tell you the same things about Brian, how he found them. You know, he had a record store. But you always hear the same things about him. The guy that wrote this book was a huge Brian Epstein fan. His story fascinated him. He did a lot of research. And it's not as much about the Beatles. It's like you see the Beatles and how he finds them, and they pop up from time to time and follow the career, but you're seeing it from Brian's side. I didn't know his family owned that record store. It wasn't him.
Yeah, yeah. He was, it was a family business, yeah. I mean, when he got started, he owned the store. But was he? Was he distributing records too at the time, or was he just selling them? Somehow or another, he got involved with the promotion or the.
Right.
Or the signing of groups or whatever. The Beatles weren't his first group.
Oh, no. Well, and they talk about that in the book. He did start doing that. And in the book, if you want to read the book.
I will read the book, yeah.
But there was a part where in the United States he met with Colonel Tom Parker, Elvis' manager. And he was thinking that, you know.
Before the Beatles?
No, he was with the Beatles. Oh, okay. The Beatles had already been on Ed Sullivan, you know.
Oh, okay.
But I guess he thought he'd really strike up a friendship because, you know, he was alone. He was a manager. He wasn't really part of the band. He wasn't part of anything. And so he thought him and Colonel Tom Parker would be related to each other, which wasn't to be. But it was a completely different thought because the way they portray him in the book was Brian was kind of a mild-mannered type person looking out for other people's interests. And they painted the Colonel as just this vicious, you know, man-eater. And he was shocked to find out that everything Elvis made was split 50-50 with the Colonel.
Okay.
And he said, you take 50% of Elvis' money? And the Colonel got upset and says, Elvis takes 50% of my money. And, you know, Brian Epstein was talking about, he was taking other acts. He had a couple of other singers that were doing pretty well.
Was it Cilla Black or somebody like that?
I think that one, there was another person. There was a couple.
And then he was getting the Beatles to, like, give them their extra songs or whatever.
Yeah.
I think. Because I know there's some compilation that's online called The Songs the Beatles Gave Away, and it's like all the stuff that they didn't record on further on. They gave to Peter and Gordon and people like that.
I got it. Well, they didn't, in the book, they didn't talk about it, but you mentioned the Colonel. The whole point was he was looking at it that he was trying to show that he wasn't lucky just by finding the Beatles, that he could do it on his own. And so he looked at it, he was taking a fair percentage from the Beatles, he was looking out for their interests, and he was also creating other acts and having success for that, showing that, you know, he was going to do it no matter what. And the Colonel was like, Elvis is the only thing he ever needs, and, you know, well, you know, there's validity to both, but... the story was fantastic. They didn't go into a lot of details. They were basically just showing his life and what was going on. And I really enjoyed it. And then when the book finishes, the writer talked about why he was so fascinated with Brian Epstein and how he did all the research and why he wrote this book.
What's fascinating to me is still the constant interest in the Beatles after 50 years. They just put out a new Rolling Stone. I think it's got another retelling of the whole story or whatever, you know. It's like, it's such a big deal to people, and it should be a big deal because it was great music, but I think we talked about this before, but in the 60s there was a lot of big deals, you know what I mean, as well as the Beatles. There was, like, for kids anyway, there was all the Batman stuff that came out, like, oh, the Monkees were like a big deal, but I mean, I guess out of all those things, they've had the most lasting. Not Batman's still pretty damn popular, though. But,
yeah.
But I'm saying, as far as music goes, they've had the longest lasting appeal, it seems like, of, you know, a lot of them. You know, so Hendrix is still extremely popular, and the Stones are still out touring.
A lot of those bands are, but there's some about the Beatles that those old recordings just resonate. All of them.
Well, they're the ones who started the band thing going.
Yeah. The self-contained singing band.
Yeah, they're the ones who started. I mean, there were others, I'm sure, before, but they were the ones that made it into, like, a big deal or whatever. And it's still fascinating to me that people still care, because people are such a disposable kind of, you know, everything's real disposable. You're into it for a year or two, and it's gone. These guys really passed the test of time.
Yeah, and, you know, that's the other thing. Before they came about, it was the producer that was the big star.
And that's the way it is now, in a way.
I didn't think of it. You're right. All those bands that come out, the boy bands and stuff, they're producers, they're manufactured, they put them together.
Yeah, it's funny. That's this real cyclical thing now. You know, I mean, I thought about that, but I never really put it together. But, yeah, when you said that, I'm thinking, yeah, a lot of these DJs or producers, it's like they're the ones responsible for redoing the music and getting it to the clubs and dancing or whatever. But you're right about that, yeah. Phil Spector and people like that. And
when the Beatles came out, it was like a sign of the new direction. And it was a self-contained singing band. They wrote their own songs. They performed their own songs. They were, you know, a package deal. And it continued on. But, you know, it's when Tina Turner made her big comeback in 84, she was talking about, people are asking why they think she got so big in the 80s. And she goes, well, I think people just went through the whole singer-songwriter thing of the late 70s.
Yeah.
And I said, then all of a sudden they have performers like her come on. Well, I mean, I like both. I love the singer-songwriters.
You know, sure, they're great.
Carole King, you know, she...
James Taylor, yeah. Neil Young, everybody.
But they wrote songs for other people through Don Kirshner and stuff, and then they started doing their own.
Well, Carole King did.
Yeah.
And some of them. The other guys, like Neil Young and right. Neil Diamond did write songs for Kirshner, but Neil Young and James Taylor, all those guys were just folky guys that kind right. of became rock guys or whatever.
But I like those too. And it meant something to me that they actually wrote the words and sang them instead of singing somebody else's, you know, what they were thinking.
Even though Carole King wrote songs for like the Monkees, like Pleasant Valley and Sunday, yeah. and she wrote songs for the Birds, I Wasn't Born to Follow, and both of the groups did a really great job interpreting the songs and all the you know, all the songs she wrote for, like, Motown and that, the artist really did a good job interpreting the words. But it was different when the artist himself sings the words.
I like both. I like both. It's, you know, one time she even made a comment that she basically wrote her songs for people like Aretha or Franklin to sing instead of, you know, lesser singers. But
yeah. Even though she did Natural Woman or whatever on that first album, Tapestry or whatever it was.
Yeah, Tapestry, what a great album. She did that You Got a Friend.
That was a big selling record, man.
Strong songs, and when she sings it, to me it just resonates through you.
I do have to say that when I was a kid, my friend had that, and that was one of those albums that, as good as it is, and I agree with you, if I'd never heard it again, I'd be happy. You know, it got a lot of airplay over my buddy's house. That and some of the Janis Joplin stuff and some of the Joe Cocker stuff, which I like the Joe Cocker still. The Janis, not so much, you know. But all icons, you know, and all, well, a lot of them died at age 27, but that's a whole different, you know.
You know, that's one thing, though. We were talking about books read about bands and stuff. There's some bands that I couldn't stand when I was growing up because you just heard them so much.
I know.
And then, you know, after that all goes away and you don't hear them for a long time and you hear it, well, actually, it's not bad. Why didn't I like that before? Well, it's because if you just have it all the time, you can't stand it anymore.
Yeah, it's like stuff like Three Dog Night. I got sick of listening to that stuff. And now I like it again for a lot of reasons because it's good pop music. That's one thing that I was thinking about the other day. And maybe you agree or maybe you don't. You know, back in the old days, you had like the singer-songwriter or the Dylan or the Beatles doing all these, like, you know, songs with all these dense lyrics or these personal lyrics. Mm-hmm. And then you had the pop stuff like, you know, the Carpenters or, you know, Sonny and Cher or the Burt Bacharach stuff or whatever. In time, for me, those pop, not all of them, a lot of those pop songs, to me now, have as much weight as the stuff that back then I thought was the really heavy-duty stuff, you know. I don't know how you feel about that, but I feel the same way, too. Because what happens is, as time goes, some of the lightweight stuff gains, whatever that word is, gravitas, gains weight or something like that in time because of, like, the production or the musicianship or the nostalgia, whatever you want to call it, you know. But at the time, I was like, wow, this is fluff. And this is great stuff.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But sometimes you don't have to be heavy. Sometimes it's just nice just to have something that sounds good.
Exactly. And, you know. But I just remember back in those days, it was just like, oh my God, I can't listen to like the Carpenters. There's like Black Sabbath here, and there's like Deep Purple, and there's like, you know, Led Zeppelin, these guys. That's like for kids or whatever, for like pop kids or girls or whatever. We're dudes. We got to listen to this raw, like, nasty music or whatever, and I guess it's old age. I don't know.
No, it's because I read, back in the mid-80s, John Cougar was in Musician Magazine, and they did a big interview with him. It was pretty interesting, and at one point, he even brought up, he mentioned that band Yes, who I'm a big fan of.
Oh, we both love
and
Yes.
He said, it's really strong, solid musicianship. He says, you can't knock him for that. But he says, what man, he's worked all day, he got off his job, he comes home, he gets a beer, he puts a record on. And he says he doesn't want to have to sit there and listen to all these constant chord changes and all this intricate music. He just wants to relax and have a good time. Well, I understood what he meant, but
I don't necessarily agree with him.
Well, I don't agree with him at all. I mean, sometimes you do like to hear simpler music that's kind of fun, but not always. To me, that was a great time to go home and listen to Yes.
You know, exactly, like, yeah, or like for like Abbey Road or something like
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. I mean, there was a bunch of bands like that, but his feeling was that it should all just be fun, relaxing music that, you know, you didn't have to think really hard for.
That's fine. That's his opinion, you know. Mm. I mean, some people have music for like different things. Like some people, oh, this is the music I go to sleep to, or this is the music I listen to in the car, or whatever. But it is what it is, you know. I mean, it just depends on the person himself. But most people that I know don't necessarily are stuck in, oh, I just listen to punk, or I just listen to heavy metal, right. Or I just listen to the. Most people that I know listen to all sorts of different styles of music.
Yeah, everybody has a lot of different tastes. The problem is they try to market everything to make as much money as they can, so you're constantly shoved with the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're trying to make massive bucks.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's the name of the game, you know. That's why the Beatles made it, because they made massive bucks and they were really good.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, sometimes in their case, that's what they were, and that's how it came out. It wasn't manufactured to be that way. And a lot of the stuff that the Beatles did, remember when they did Hey Jude, you know, and Paul McCartney had it, and it's, well, how long was the song, like 7 minutes or 7.5 minutes? And they said, there's no radio station in the world that's going to play a 7.5 minute song. And then John Lennon said, they will if it's us. And then Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah.
They said that was too long, they didn't want to do it. Well, the band insisted, and they put the album out the way it was. Big hit. So, I mean, sometimes breaking the norm is different.
I think Good Vibrations was a long song, too, that was a hit single. I think that was like 5 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, I always enjoyed that song.
Yeah, that's a great song. I mean, that's another guy who was the producer, but, you know, he was also the songwriter, so it was a little bit different. I mean, I think Spectre was a songwriter, too. I'm not 100% sure, but he was basically, like, more known for the production. But with the Beatles, I always thought the fifth Beatle was George Harrison. George Martin myself, you know?
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, George Martin, it wouldn't happen if it wasn't for him. And he had a lot to do with all the music he did. He did all the orchestral parts.
Sure.
He played, I'm trying to think of which one it was. One of the songs he played, the harpsichord or whatever.
Yeah, you know? I can't think of it right now, but yeah.
But, I mean, Paul McCartney in the recording sessions, when they asked him what he thought of George Martin, he said, sympathetic. Which at the time I thought was kind of strange, because you think of the Beatles as like this massive group that nobody could touch, and why would you be sympathetic to it? But he said, no, he was always sympathetic. He said, no matter what kind of ideas we had, he never told us, you kids don't know what you're doing, it's like this, which a lot of people would do. He said he always listened to them, and he tried to, you know, there were times where he tried to explain to them that's not always a good idea. He says, but he always tried to work it out with them and show them, you know, why it would work or why it wouldn't. But like I said, if you ever read some of those studio logs, all the stuff George Martin did, it's amazing.
Yeah, he pieced together all for the psychedelic stuff, he pieced together all the sound effects and, you mm-hmm. know, did all the collages and all that stuff that, you know, I doubt that, you know, the other guys would have been able to figure out on their own.
The one thing Penny Lane, if you ever heard different versions of it, you know, one of them was the real fast version, like they play at the end of the song.
Yeah.
And there's slower versions. And there's something, a mutual friend of ours had, a recording of it was, I guess, the studio logs, and George Martin was talking, playing the songs, and he would just take one channel off. You used to hear like the drums and the piano on one track, you know, and he would explain why they were doing it, and so they recorded it, thought it was finished, and John would come in, I think I could do it better, and so they recorded it several times, and they kept redoing it, but there was a fast track. And then there was a slower one. And John couldn't make up his mind which one he wanted. So finally he just told George Martin, I want it to start slow, and then at the end I want it to end with a faster. And George Martin was kind of grinding his teeth over it, so he just figured it out. So George Martin basically spliced it together. And I think Jeff Emmerich was talking about, to this day, George Martin can't listen to it because he can hear exactly where he cut it. But nobody ever complained. Huh. Well, I never noticed it. You know, I'm telling you, you didn't notice it.
No, I mean, but I have heard that story before. Now, I know there's another version of Penny Lane where there's like, there's the horns at the end or something like that. I mean, a different edit of it or whatever. But I had forgotten that the speed fuck. It's pretty subtle, though.
It is subtle, but, you know, when the CD, I bought the Magical Mystery Tour CD, and in the liner notes, George Martin talks about it, tells the whole story again. And it says, I still can't listen to it to this day. But he told exactly what number it was, because, you know, on the CD, it lists the time. And he says, if you want to know where I cut it, it's right here. And he gave the time. And he says, but when I, you know, you read this, I'm telling you this, but I'm warning you. If you pay attention, your CD player notice it, you're going to notice that cut for the rest of your life. So I never looked. I never. So I don't want to know. But if you want to mess the song up for the rest of your life, go ahead and look it up and find out and watch your CD player.
Well, somebody said that on one, I think it's on the Led Zeppelin album or on a song or something, I don't know. But I think John Bonham's bass pedal squeaks. And if you find it, and it'll be stuck in your head forever. Yeah. You know, you can hear that, so you kind of don't want to.
Well, that's it. If you notice something, you know, certain things, it'll just take it away. Or if you meet a creator or a musician that you really liked a lot and find out they're a jerk, you just never read their stuff or listen to their stuff the same way.
And it just could have been a jerk for that day.
Yeah, maybe you just met them at a bad time.
You know? Yeah, you know what I mean? I guess the thing is, if you're famous, you have to be nice all the time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Everybody has bad times at times.
Then when you get home, you can throw plates at the wall or, you know, or do whatever you want to do. But now, when you were a kid, did you see the Beatles on Led Sullivan, or was that? No, you were just born.
Well, my parents tell me that I did, but I was too young to notice. But we were from a small town in Texas. Right. And my parents, you know, they were complete. They like rockabilly, you know, the old rock and roll.
Oh, that's good stuff.
But they were mostly country. You know, growing up, my dad always listened to Hank Williams, Johnny Cash. Those were his favorites. But then, you know, country and gospel, that kind of thing was the big thing with all the families there. And the Beatles came on, and Mom always laughed that their friends were watching it with them, and like, look how long their hair is. Well, you know, if you see them now, it looks really tame, but at the time in Texas, I mean, you know, everybody had real close crop military looking hair.
Sure.
You know? And but no, I didn't know. I remember as kids, we'd always just sing Yeah, Yeah, Yeah all the time. It says we're the Beatles. And then we rented a basement apartment in Utah. And the people that lived upstairs, you know, that owned the building, they were good friends of my parents, and I guess they were at a record club together. And one morning, my mom and I are going up the stairs to go out in town, and a woman stuck her head out the door and said, Don, I got something for you. And it was Meet the Beatles.
Wow.
And I was so excited. I was 3. And come to find out, I didn't know until years and years later, it was the record club that was the record of the month, and they sent it, and they didn't bother sending it back, and it was too late, and they didn't want it. You know, they were country people, so they gave it to me.
That's pretty cool. You still have it?
Yeah, it's not playable anymore. It's one of those things you just can't get rid of. But
no, hell no.
And it was funny because I just listened to those constantly, and I know it drove my parents crazy. My parents liked the Beatles, but they were like, that's all he listens to. And then when my daughter was 3 and she, you know, they showed the Beatles anthology on TV, I had one cassette tape. I didn't have any stuff on CD at the time. And so she found the tape. She just started listening to it over and over and over and over and over. And sometimes my wife would go in, okay, honey, it's enough. The Beatles are tired. I ended up talking to my dad one time and told him that, and Dad was laughing. I says, I guess what I'm trying to tell you, Dad, is I'm very sorry. like we just said, even if you love something, if you just keep hearing Revolver constantly over and over and over, you know.
Yeah, you kind of drive people crazy or whatever.
But if you're into it, that's, you know, that's what you want to hear.
Now, when you were a kid, Did you ever see the Beatle cartoons on Saturday morning?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay. Because that's how I got introduced to a lot of the other songs, not from the radio, but from the Beatle cartoons.
Yeah, and that was a funny thing. I remember they played Strawberry Fields.
Yeah, I know.
That one, you know, I remember Come Together was on the radio. I was 8 years old, and they were constantly playing it. And I thought the Beatles still looked like they did, you know, during the Rubber Soul type thing.
Hey.
And it wasn't until years later, like 74, when I started looking at their albums, what, that's the Beatles? And because I just always thought they were the Mop Tops. And but yeah, I remember that car. How long did that cartoon run? Because
I think from 66 to 68 or something like that, something around that. Because I mean,
well, it was always on TV. I remember when it
was
first,
on. It was on Saturday morning.
Yeah, when it first came on, I remember it was on other. It seemed like I know it was on Saturday morning, but I remember it being on other times.
Okay, I don't remember that.
Because my parents, I was somebody's friend, and it came on TV. I mean, it was always, no matter where you went, the Beatles were there. And
yeah.
The cartoon they showed, and I remember, I think in 67, they came on really early in the morning. It wasn't later, you know, like one of the first Saturday morning cartoons. But I used to get up and watch it, and I just, I liked this show. And that's when I remember they were playing Strawberry Fields. And I remember later in that day, my dad would be working on something. And my dad was the kind of guy who'd always whistle and hum and sing songs. And he was singing Strawberry Fields.
Wow.
But, you know, he must have heard on the radio or something. But
yeah, because that was a weird song when I first heard that.
Oh, yeah. It was.
That was a strange song. They go, here's a new single by the Beatles. And you're like, you know, huh? What?
Well, they were always doing that. I don't know when Rubber Soul came out. Everybody's like, what? This is the Beatles?
Yeah, because you know which one was the first one that made me go, what? It was Yellow Submarine. A kid I knew had a 45, and he plays it, and he's like playing this song. I go, who's that? It's the Beatles. I go, well, that's the Beatles? Wow, that doesn't sound like anything I remember, but okay, you know.
Yeah, I'd always hear these and love it. And I remember on that recording session, John Lennon, he said when he wrote the song, he just couldn't resist the thought of little kids walking around singing that song over and over. Well, it worked because in Oklahoma, that's what we did. You know, we were always singing it, you know, and it always had an odd sound. I remember in cereal boxes, you could get Yellow Submarine stickers.
Oh, okay.
And I remember one of my friends, his father was really offbeat. I mean, I liked him, but he was really offbeat. And this is in 68, I think. And I was over at his house, and his dad had some type of woodwind flute. It had a really strange sound. He was playing it kind of like a clarinet.
Like a recorder or something like
that?
Well,
it was made out of wood.
Okay.
It might have been a recorder, but it was wood. And, you know, his dad had an ashtray that was the skull with the granny glasses on it, you know. I mean, it just, you know, which is common stuff now, but at the time, it was just way out there. His dad was playing, I remember he had kind of like a Prince Albert, you know, the chin beard. You know,
oh, so he was a hipster, dad was.
Well, but he worked with my dad. They were friends. But, yeah, he was a lot different than my
dad. Well, your dad was a musician, too, right?
Yeah, my dad was a
guitar jam or play or anything like that?
Well, this guy was a musician, but he was playing the flute. And my friend pointed out that on the flute, he had that sticker from the cereal box. It was the Green Apple Bonkers, which fit along the flute. But, you know, if I would have put a sticker on my dad's guitar, it would have came off immediately. I was surprised this guy had it on there. But I just remember seeing that, and I don't know why Yellow Submarine, that song, I just always hear these really strange bassoons and odd Dr. Seuss kind of instruments to it. You know, I always liked it, but I was kind of finding these. I was looking from I'm a few years younger than you, so there was I was catching it in a different time, and I don't know. It was all kind of odd, but to me in a fun way.
Yeah, well, it really was. Everything was kind of like merged together. You know, you had this the rock music on Saturday morning, and then you had the rock music, the Beatles with your cereals. It was like this old, all omnipresent thing. And at that point, you know, like Elvis had already kind of become, not obsolete, but he had become kind of like a movie star doing his almost like teen movies kind of.
Well,
in a
he
way.
Was singing for the people that were afraid of him in the 50s.
Yeah, I never thought about that.
He was the counterculture, and he was scary. And then later, he was singing to housewives. You know, he became a recipe. It wasn't exciting anymore. Which, when I say that, I like those movies.
I do too.
And you know,
they're fun.
My mom always watched them, and we last summer, my wife and daughter and I went to Graceland. You know, and it was on the way, and Myrna says something about, all right, let's stop. And what was funny was we were pulling up, there's a sign, Welcome to Graceland. And there's another couple with their son. And the boy comes up and goes, excuse me, sir, would you mind taking our picture? Of course. They're from Germany. My wife was talking, they came from Germany. And
wow.
I took the picture. And, of course, my wife wanted our picture taken in front of the sign. And the father, he just smiled and said, well, take advantage of it, because this is the destination. He was so excited. You know, he was, I guess around my age, he was a doctor. His son was a medical student. But they came over from Germany to see Graceland.
And wow.
Throughout the tour, I see him watching the video somewhere. And, you know, the father was a quiet man, but you could see he was just really enjoying himself, you know, seeing all this stuff. But my wife, before we left, said, honey, I have to get one of these movies. And, of course, we didn't, because they were all $30-something at the store. I found them at Walmart for $4.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But Speedway, that's the one I bought, Speedway.
And, that's the one with Nancy Sinatra.
Yeah. But she like, honey, this is fun. Yeah, they were all fun.
They were fun movies. Yeah, I never have a problem with them. I mean, back in the day, you know, you were more into the Beatles. But now when I see them on TV, you know, they've got that 60s vibe to them with the, you know, with the people.
Exactly. Well, here's, growing up, my parents loved Elvis. My dad loved him. And I couldn't stand him. I remember a friend moved in. This is in 67. They came from Chattanooga, Tennessee. It was their next-door neighbors. And I'm in a house, and he showed me all these records he had. And he kept showing me Elvis Presley. He kept telling me how much he loved him. Well, I'm looking at the picture. It was just kind of this fat guy with weird-looking hair. You know, these RCA records. I said, who is this guy? Well, you know, later I started hearing it. I don't know. I just never cared for him. My mom would always watch the movies. I'd watch them too. But I'd always make the comment, I don't understand what's so big about Elvis. And I remember when he died, you know, in 72, or not 77, and the Pope had died. And I remember my grandfather made a comment. He says, we were watching a football game in Texas, and it announced the Pope died, which I didn't know who the Pope was at the time. But then, not long after, Elvis died, and later my grandfather said, he's kind of scratching his head. He says, you know, there's more people interested in Elvis dying than the Pope. And I said, isn't that something? I'm kind of bewildered, you know, but I never really saw the appeal to Elvis Presley until 86, or 85 or 86, when they announced the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he was one of the inductees with Little Richard and Chuck
Berry. Yeah, the
original
guys, yeah.
And who were all awesome. But they were showing Elvis Presley on the Ed Sullivan Show, in black and white. And when I saw that, I thought, my God, no wonder. No wonder people loved him. He was awesome! But, you know, the Elvis I saw was after he went to RCA Records. And like I said, I do like the movies, but that wasn't Elvis anymore.
I'm wondering if the Colonel toned him down a little bit.
Well, the Colonel had a lot to do with it. The Colonel was the one that signed him up for that record, the movies.
Yeah.
And at Graceland, it was showing Priscilla Presley talking about that 67 comeback special, or the 68 comeback.
Yeah, 68, yeah.
And she said they finally got him out of that horrible movie deal. I kind of find out the Colonel didn't even watch the movies. He was just getting
just
the money.
Just counting the money, yeah.
But, you know, like I said, there's the Sun. If you ever hear those old Elvis Presley Sun record.
The 50s ones, yeah, they're rocking.
Man, those are awesome. Blue suede shoes, all this stuff.
Those are rocking, yeah.
They are rocking.
I mean, the Beatles were big fans. That's where they got a lot of their, music from, was those earlier Sun records.
Yeah, but when he went to RCA, it was, you know, different, which I understand times change and stuff like that. But saying that, I mean, and we went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Ohio. They have a whole Elvis section. I enjoyed seeing it. You know, all the badges he collected and all the peacock suits and stuff he had.
Yeah, right.
You know, they had a movie, and my wife was sitting there watching it, and I ended up going and seeing more of the museum. She stayed there and watched the whole movie and was giddy about it. And was so excited about, you know, showing all the girls screaming for him and stuff like that and how they're about to fall over. And she just thought that was the funnest thing. And that was her favorite thing at the museum was Elvis.
Oh, I'm sure it was,
you know,
yeah.
So, I mean, he was the king.
Because she remembers him better than some of the other bands.
Well, she loved the Beatles. You know, her brother, one of her older brothers, collected everything Beatles. He, you know, I mean, she was more of a Beatles thing, but Elvis was something that, you know, she had seen as well.
Yeah, no, definitely, yeah. All right, let's take a break here, and we're going to play maybe some of the music that we were talking about, maybe, or some of the imitators, maybe, but we'll be right back after these musical interludes.
The annual exhibitors and distributors meeting will please come to order. If the motion picture industry is dead, it will be Monty Python who killed it.
And now for something completely different. From Columbia Pictures, rated PG. And now for something completely different. Worse than the Holy Grail.
Yeah. because the world is round. Because the wind is high, it blows my mind. Because the wind is high. Love is old, love is new. Love is old, love is you. Because the sky is blue, it makes me cry. Because the sky is blue.
You loaned me some of those cartoons, the Lone Ranger ones. And since we're talking about the Beatle cartoons.
These were out at the same time.
Yeah, they were out at the same time. You know, and the Lone Ranger stuff I don't remember ever seeing before. But I do remember now seeing in the comic books the advertisement for those. So you said you remember them vividly when you were a kid.
They came out. We were living in Oklahoma. We went a lot in Oklahoma from Texas for a brief period of time, and that's when the cartoon came on. And my dad was a huge Lone Ranger fan as a kid. He knew the radio show, and I guess he knew the Clayton Moore stuff later, but mostly the radio show. And, you know, Dad would see me watching the show, and he says, "What does the Lone Ranger say?" You know, "Hi-ho, Silver." But my dad would yell it out with that kind of yodel like he did. And he says, "What does Tonto say?" "I don't know. Get him up, Scout." You know. But the cartoon had a unique look to it, and we moved to Colorado. Every time I went to somebody's house, that show was on.
Wow.
And then later we moved to Oklahoma City, and that was the last I remember of that show. It came on for, I guess I saw it for another year. And it was unique. It just had a neat look, and a neat graphic look that I haven't seen before
More
since. And I've never seen the cartoon again, but when I think of the Lone Ranger, and I've seen the Clayton Moore TV show, and it's very good, and I like Clayton Moore, but I always remember it from that cartoon. And a friend of mine sent me a copy of it, he had on VHS tape. And yeah, they really stand up strong. I guess they were trying to make it look like the Wild Wild West.
It looks like the Wild Wild West, like those cartoons in between the segments or whatever.
Well, then I was reading about the animation company, because I've never heard of them. But they did the Lone Ranger cartoon. I guess they did 2 seasons, and it ran for 3 seasons. I guess they repeated. And then what did they show them?
So they were popular enough to go on for 3 seasons.
But those, I guess they didn't really do Saturday morning animation anymore, but they did some animation. The Hee-Haw, you know, they always had the dancing chickens. And they did Hee-Haw, and they did some other, like, commercials and stuff I was reading online. But that cartoon, I'm watching it again. Like I said, sometimes there's things you loved as a kid and you remember fondly, and then you see it again and you go, "Well, that's kind of, you know." So I figured that's what it would be like, but it wasn't that way at all. I found I enjoyed it as much now as I did then, and I'd say it was kind of groundbreaking. And the voice work was strong.
Yeah, it was like some studios had their look, like Hanna-Barbera had a look, Filmation had a look, and that one looks pretty different. The Beetle cartoon stuff, King Features, I think, or I forgot who it was. Was it King Features or somebody? They had a different look to them or whatever. So, and the Lone Rangers had a completely different look from all the rest of them.
You know, whenever I think of the Beatles cartoon, I always remember how it opened, all those screaming girls chasing them when they were running away.
They had different opens, though. I've seen them on YouTube. Uh-huh. They have different opens through the years, but that's one of them, yeah.
That's the one I always remember. And maybe I filled in the blanks with something that I put on my own, but I thought at the end of one of them, there was a mermaid at the end of it with all those girls.
Maybe.
There was a mermaid that came up and was chasing the Beatles with all the girls. But every time I tell somebody, oh, I don't remember that.
I'll have to find it. I mean, YouTube has those, or some of them anyway, because for some reason or another, they don't put them out on DVD, which is like, you know, doesn't make sense to me.
Somebody gave me a bunch of stuff that got offline, and he was warning me. They didn't age well.
But the songs are still cool. No, they don't age well.
But I remember watching them. I guess they were kind of like Englishmen imagined by Americans in New York. And that made Ringo seem so stupid.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And the voices, I mean, I think it was Paul Frees who was the Pillsbury Doughboy, among other things. I think he was doing some of their voices too. So they really sound like they're, even though Ringo maybe, but the other ones didn't really sound like they're real Beatles.
But, you know, as a kid, I loved Ringo. Watching that cartoon, I thought he was great.
Oh, yeah.
I just remember I guess in between the little shows, they have, you know, fillers. And Paul was in front of a curtain, I guess, introduced
a song. Yeah, we got a song, a sing-along song.
And then Ringo would come up with something he was doing. And Paul's like, well, Ringo, you're going to blow us to smithereens. Yeah. And then Ringo's like, I'm not going to blow you to some of the ruins.
And then and then say, okay, kids, and they would go like, and for you, Joey, and you, Johnny, and you, Debbie, sing along or whatever. So just some kids in the audience are like, oh, Paul's talking to me, and then like, here comes my song or whatever. It was definitely a good gimmick, no doubt about it, you know. But I mean, what I was trying to get at was, I guess, are there Saturday morning cartoons now on the networks, or is that just a thing of the past?
I think they do, but I don't know if they're. It's not the big package.
It's not the big deal that it was back then.
Well, you know, you got Cartoon Network was 24 hours of cartoons.
And there's that one Boomerang that shows all old cartoons.
Yeah, that's another one. And you got Nickelodeon, which has really big cartoon packages.
Yeah, and they're made for them or whatever.
And they used to have, they don't anymore, but I remember TBS used to show a lot of Looney Tunes.
And yeah.
There was a bunch of channels that showed a lot of Looney Tunes.
Yeah, they sure did.
Now none of them seem to.
No, I've never seen them in a long time. I don't know why. Yeah, I mean, I have old videotapes of movies. And in between the movies sometimes, you'll have like a... And now we're going to a cartoon break, and they'll play like a Bugs Bunny cartoon in between. And you're like, oh, that's pretty cool.
Well, even Nickelodeon showed Looney Tunes. And I remember Nickelodeon, I think it was TBS, used to show cartoons of Bosco. Remember
him? Really? Bosco? Yeah, vaguely remember that.
I didn't remember Bosco. They'd show him the old black and white ones from Merry Melodies. And to me, it was fascinating to see them. And then later, Nickelodeon was advertising that, you know, they show Looney Tunes, nothing but Looney Tunes, and no Bosco. And they kept saying, well, it was because TBS showed Bosco.
Oh.
Bosco was, if you didn't know...
Was Bosco a clown?
Yeah, kind of a little tramp-type clown.
Vague,
I just remember every time he'd run into, like, a ferocious beast or something, he'd always tip his hat and offer him gum. Gum? And then the song would ensue.
Now I got to find those. I kind of don't.
Bosco was, I think he was the first character from Merry Melodies. Because Merry Melodies was always, you know, musical numbers and stuff. But I guess they realized they needed to have a cartoon personality. So Bosco was the one they came up with. And there's still song and dance numbers on cartoons. And but Bosco, I don't think really ever resonated with anybody. It was just kind of there. And then later you started getting, what was it, Egghead was the next one?
Who I don't remember any of those.
Egghead eventually became Elmer Fudd.
Really? He was called Egghead before he was Elmer Fudd?
Yeah, there was a character called Egghead, and he was always on it. And he didn't look like Elmer Fudd. He was bald and had a bowler hat and a red nose.
Huh.
And then later they did, you know, that whole, there was a rabbit that Egghead was chasing, and the rabbit was kind of obnoxious.
Was it Oswald?
Well, it became Bugs Bunny.
Okay.
But it wasn't at the time. It was just a crazy rabbit. And then later, you know, there was a popular cartoon, and they just got working with it, and eventually that rabbit was tweaked into Bugs Bunny. And then later, I guess they brought Egghead back, and eventually Egghead became Elmer Fudd.
Oh, okay. See, because my introduction to the Looney Tunes stuff was the old, the Saturday morning show, you know, with the intro that, you know, hit the lights, you know, all that stuff. I always used to watch that all the time.
Yeah, me too. I always watch it. And no matter how many times you've seen it, you still watch it.
You still laugh, yeah.
One time, my wife, I guess we've been married about a year and a half, and my wife is an early riser. When the sun cracks, she's up. She just can't sleep anymore. And I just remember we had a little tiny one-bedroom apartment, and I just remember I'm laying there, and you could feel your wife just wake up. She just laid there for a minute wondering if I was going to stir. And then she quietly got out of bed and went to the living room and turned the TV on. And then I heard, that's all, folks. And constantly. And her just squealing and giggling. And then later when I got up, all she talked about was the Looney Tune. They had the coyote, but he wasn't the coyote. He was the wolf.
Oh,
and Sam,
okay.
The sheepdog.
Yeah, I remember that. Is that the one where they punch in for work or whatever?
Morning Ralph, Morning Sam.
Yeah, that's a great cartoon.
I remember I was a kid in Lawton, Oklahoma. I saw that one morning. I thought, well, that's the coyote. Why is he talking? And I thought, well, they're friends. Why is he punching? Why are they doing this? You know, I didn't understand that. But she thought that was the funniest thing she'd ever seen in her life.
It might have been.
Well, I mean, you know, the Looney Tunes, they resonate with everybody.
Oh, my God. Yeah, well, that was just part of it, though. I remember it was like, I remember my favorite year of cartoons was when the Spider-Man cartoons were on.
Yeah.
Fantastic Four. I think there was Casper. Pretty sure the Beatles were on, and then Looney Tunes came on.
I think
that was the block.
Yeah. The one thing I didn't quite understand, somebody I worked with bought a TV guide for 67.
Yeah.
And there was an article inside it I read, and I do remember Saturday morning cartoons were a big thing. We always got up and watched them. That's when they showed the block of cartoons. And I still remember in the comic books, they always had that two-page center spread preview on, like, you know, the Aquaman cartoon.
The Filmations, yeah.
But, the whole lineup on CBS or whatever. But it was in, I guess it was the fall of 67 or 68. But that's when they were showing the Mighty Mitor and, David and Goliath.
Davy and Goliath, yeah.
No, the Hanna-Barbera one. The guy on the motor scooter with the dog.
Oh, yeah. I know which one you're talking about,
David and Goliath.
Samson, is it?
No. Oh, Samson and Goliath. That was it,
Samson and Goliath.
Samson and Goliath. And what was the Herculoids?
Those are great,
and
man.
But they had a whole lineup of it, and they were pushing it, advertising it heavy. And me and my cousin would always talk about the superhero with the horns. It was Mitor. And we didn't know what his name was. We just kept saying superheroes with the horns. But I remember my aunt, who, you know, she was in high school at the time. We came in to watch cartoons, and she'd been watching them. And it just seemed like it was a big to-do. And then this TV guy they were talking about, I guess they made a whole block for Saturday morning. It wasn't just old cartoons that they showed. They did make new cartoons for Saturday morning because
the
Ranger came out.
Of course they did, yeah.
The Beatles cartoon, but...
The Fantastic Four Spider-Mans were new, yeah.
Yeah, but those were new, but they'd show old cartoons.
Well, the Looney Tunes were repackaged.
Right. But I guess at that point, they just started making a whole package of brand new cartoons.
Yeah.
Which, it was nice, but I liked it when they mixed them up, because some of those cartoons later just seemed like they were just kind of throwing them in and out. You know, just...
Well, the older cartoons I remember were on the, if you had an independent station, like a UHF, you'd get some of the older stuff or whatever.
Yeah, which was awesome.
Speed Racer, Prince Planet, Kimba the White Lion, Astro Boy. Right. And that's where those Marvel cartoons came on, that again, even though people say they didn't age well, they still resonate with me as that was my first introduction to the Marvel Universe. That and the Fantastic Four and the Spider-Man cartoons.
You know, it's something you're talking about introduction. I never would have thought that you'd ever see Marvel cartoons. You know, I mean, because they were part of the counterculture. They were so different, and they were an underground theme. You know, it's funny because I was joking in 1988 at work about the Ramones. And they were saying, you know, they could use Ramones songs for commercials for products.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would never happen. You know, even then, the Ramones were still considered a punk
rock band.
And I just started making up products like TDK, you know, the cassette tapes. And I took the KKK, took my baby away.
Right. TDK.
TDK took the static away. They took it away from me. You know, I'm afraid all that would never happen. Well, it didn't happen to Ramones, but every rock song you ever loved is.
Yeah, the Who do that a lot.
You know, it's funny. The one that offended me the most was when they used Jimi Hendrix Fire for a Camaro commercial, and it was just so dorky.
Yeah.
So Jimmy never would have done that. And it was just. I remember they used Mountains Mississippi Queen for a light beer commercial.
Yeah, that's a lot of money for some of those guys, man.
But it was something that just irritated me. But yeah, at the same time, the Who, I never got upset about. I remember they used their song for the Tommy's Overture for Clarinax or something. They used Happy Jack for a Hummer commercial.
Yep. Yeah.
They used
one of those songs. It's either Won't Get Fooled Again or Bob O'Reilly for the intro to CSI.
Yeah, CSI was Who Are You?
Who Are You, that's it.
And then CSI Miami was Won't Get Fooled Again. And then CSI New York, they were using Bob O'Reilly.
Oh, so the three shows had three different Who songs. Oh, my God.
And here's what's funny, going off on a side note, and that never offended me. I thought they were really clever what they did. But that TV show, Two and a Half Men.
Yeah.
There was one episode where one of the guy's ex-wife was trying out for the CSI type show. And she was doing the lines. The woman had, you know, large breasts. And she's following the script, and she's supposed to be an examiner. And she's looking over and removing her glasses. And she's always poking her breast out in front of the camera. So why? That, it says this in the strip, Alan. And they said, what's the name of the show? Stiffs. For dead bodies and all and at the end, you know, the whole episode goes on, and eventually she gets the part, and then the show ends, and they show the scene on television, you know, and she's doing the whole scene, and it wasn't dorky, it was kind of cool, but they did it just like CSI. She took off her glasses, moved over the body, showed her breast to the screen, and then after she made her point, the opening credits come up, and it shows the word Stiffs. And they're playing the Who's Squeeze Box for the song. And I fell over laughing. My wife didn't quite get it, but they used that one. So, yeah, I don't know why the Who, when they use their songs for commercials, it never bothered me. But it did for other people. And that was another thing in Two and a Half Men. You know, Charlie Sheen was a jingle writer. He was always writing jingles for different, you know, products, hemorrhoid creams and stuff like that, cereal. And then later he wasn't. I said, why? He says, well, why would you pay a jingle writer when you take an old rock song
exactly.
and use that? And that's absolutely what happened. Now
exactly.
You use rock songs all the time. And I guess that's what irritates me is, you know, whenever I hear it's nothing like the real thing, it's not a song anymore. It was a jingle for Burger King's chicken tenders. You know, it's So, yeah.
Some songs will never be used for those reasons, but yeah, the biggies probably will. You know, some. That's why I like the smaller cult bands, because you know that pretty much the songs will never be used to promote, you know, condoms or tampons or anything.
Wait
like
20
that.
Years to see what happens.
Oh, God, I hope not.
Well, that
you
was
know?
Something Paul McCartney came under fire for, because the Beatles never did that. And then when Michael Jackson sold Revolution to Adidas, and the Beatles took it to court, and basically the way it worked was they could still use Beatles songs, but not the Beatles performances. And when Paul McCartney was in a phone an interview on the radio, somebody brought that up, that Paul McCartney owned Buddy Holly's library.
Yeah, he did.
And I remember Toyota was using that so easy for It's So Easy to Own Tercel.
Yeah.
And Paul McCartney said, I knew that this would come up. The Beatles, we didn't do that, and Buddy Holly. But he said, but the difference is, when Buddy Holly was alive and writing the songs, he used to do that. He used to sell the songs for other people to write. It never bothered Buddy, and that's fine. So that's why I follow suit with it. And he says, I don't let it all the time. But he says, the Beatles, we never did. And we could have made a lot more money at the time, had we, but we didn't want to. And so that's why they're for it. Some bands, I don't know, I guess if you got somebody like Bob Dylan that's sitting there preaching all this stuff, and he's selling songs for sinus medication, well, that's kind of a sellout.
Blowing in the wind for sinus medication. Hey, you got hay fever? Oh,
yeah.
It must be blowing in the wind. take some Xanax or something.
You got, you know, other bands that are lighter and just kind of fun. You know, I don't really see a problem with it.
Well, there's some commercial. I don't remember what it was, but I seem to remember there's like these two barbarian guys beating each other up. But it's got this great Lou Reed song called Perfect Day. But the thing is, I'm not sure if
it's for a video game.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they're using his performance or they redid it. But it's such a great song. I was like, what? But hey, you know, Lou made some money off it. So I guess it's his song. He can do whatever you want with it. You know what I mean? You know, you wonder sometimes, these guys write these songs, they never meant them to be like these anthems or these like, you know, it was just another song I wrote, you know? And they become like something to people because of their experiences, and then they become Toyota commercials or game commercials or whatever. Yeah,
trivialized down to nothing.
Yeah, and that's probably one of the reasons why rock music has lost a lot of its importance, I think. So, and that'll be the lead-in for probably the next episode of Destination Nightmare that we do. So yeah, we're already hitting an hour and a half mode. So I guess we gotta say goodbye. What other things do we do? Don't we do a comic book podcast too? I think.
Oh yeah, we do the Two Dimension Comic Book Podcast. The comic book podcast with no direction.
Where you have to click on the Cyclops.
Yeah, you can go to bunchdorks.com and then click on the Cyclops.
And you can go on Slow Robot a Go Go there and listen to movie reviews.
That's with you and who?
Mao, not Dr. Mao, but Mao. And then you can, you know, look at comics and good stuff on this blog. So, yeah.
Today when it becomes tomorrow, I will leave.
can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go-Go, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops!